The K-12 Education Committee will come to order. Welcome back from weekend. I hope you had a restful one. The first bill up on our agenda is House File 2857, Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thank you for taking the time today. I'd like to move House File 2857 be included in the omnibus, topic during the omnibus bill, and there's a DE2 amendment. Madam Chair.
All right. There is a DE2 amendment. Do we have that in our packet? Okay. Is it in everyone's packet?
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Abel would like to move the DE2 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposition? The amendment is adopted. All right. You want to explain it then?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be very brief and I'll turn over to my testifier. The Anoka, as you district has a relatively sparse compensatory population, and as such, some of the effects that happen in more densely populated compensatory districts aren't able to happen in Anoka. And so this is a pilot project allowing them to allocate the money with a bit more focus. And with that, I'll turn over to my witness, who is a school board member, Tom Heidegger.
All right. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you so much for allowing me to come back. This is compensatory aid has been a topic that I've talked about before in this body, and I appreciate the help that we've received in the past to solve some of those issues. There's basically, for Anoka-Hennepin, there's two basic issues we have with the compensatory aid, and we've talked about the previous one before, which is the dollars that we get are not aligned to what's really required to provide the remedial services and to make sure that every child is brought up to the appropriate level. That's basically one issue. We have a fairly large deficit in terms of the remedial work that we have to do for those students versus what we get in compensatory aid. On top of that, we just learned on Friday that we're going to lose $1 million of title funding effective next year, which is really an additional blow to Anoka-Hennepin. The second issue we have in Anoka is that we don't have the strong correlation that you might find in the inner cities between free and reduced lunch and students needing additional services. We can show by looking at the test scores that we don't have that strong correlation. Many of you will remember that Dr. Saunders has been here a couple times and he talked about value-added testing. I was at one of those discussions that Dr. Saunders had. I was invited by Representative Abler. Found it to be very interesting, and Anoka-Hennepin has implemented that type of value-added testing that allows us to do testing in core areas, and we do that through the use of technology. We get those test results to the teachers within 24 hours, so it becomes a useful tool in testing, and we can do that at the beginning and the end of the year. So we do have a lot of test scores to look at, and we need to be able to have some flexibility to focus the dollars to where we need to improve performance. And again, we don't have that strong correlation that one would expect and is often found in the inner city schools. So we would really appreciate to have that flexibility.
Do you have another testifier?
I do, Madam Chair. And yeah, I'll just introduce Dave Buck, who's the CEO. He'll have a few thoughts.
Madam Chair, my name is Dave Buck. I'm Director of Business Services with the Anoka-Hennepin School District. And I'm basically here from a business management standpoint saying, you know, we're given a finite amount of dollars that we have to work with in Anoka-Hennepin and need to become more precise as to how we use those to make sure that the children in Anoka-Hennepin get the resources they need to go forward. And as we looked at the test scores and looked at where we found children below grade level, there really wasn't a good alignment between that and the distribution of compensatory. And so what we're looking at is to have a period of time where we can better align some of our compensatory dollars to those test scores and apply them to help the kids in those schools to see if we can't move them ahead at a quicker rate.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Abel.
And the talk was that with this flexibility, I know there's a few schools that didn't make AYP, or at least that are at risk of that. I'm not sure of the numbers, but they thought that with this flexibility, they could target some of those schools and actually bring them up to AYP with the same dollars. So that's the point of the pilot, and it's kept purposely small. And there's a report every year for 3 years, and then we'll see if it comes true. I think that Anoka is well poised to do this, and I hope you can support the bill.
All right. Representative Freiland.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Abler, or any of your testifiers. How do you, obviously you'll do the pilot, and that will help you to try to find out, but how do we know, and I worry that, you know, in the meanwhile, we may do something to the success. How do we know that the reason the test scores don't correlate is because of the success of the funding following the students who are on free and reduced lunch? Maybe it's a success story that we're cutting in on here.
Mr. Heineman?
There is very well a possibility of that, but what we're finding is that the compensatory $8, as they're generated in a lot of our schools, aren't sufficient to cover a lot of the issues. And there are alternative funding sources that we have to target remedial services. Dave, did you want to?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Grayling, what I've seen, and I'm looking at it from a business side. I'm not the person who does the testing, but what I've seen is if you look at the test scores that we have, and you look at where the bulk of the kids are below grade level, and the type of funding that's flowing into those buildings, we don't have in Okanagan, we don't have thousands of kids that we're talking about here. It doesn't look like a Minneapolis or St. Paul. It's a smaller group of kids that we have to really become more effective with. And with a little bit of tweaking on those dollars in terms of where we can place them and the type of additional programming we can bring into those schools, we think we're going to have a lot of effect on those kids that are below grade level, and we'd like to try it. That's essentially what we're doing.
Representative Brown?
Yep, Madam Chair. Well, I'm not entirely comfortable with raising money for one purpose and using it for another. And the fact that that we're looking at testing criteria, it seems to me there's other criteria besides a paper and pencil test that we, maybe the students are who are generating the money, they need other things besides the things that a paper and pencil test would measure that they're getting. What are you currently spending the money on for the kids on free and reduced lunch?
Madam Chair, Representative Grayling. The whole realm of things right now, anything that's legal within the law under compensatory ed, we have lots of programs. We actually spend more than we're getting in right now, but the ability to move some of that money to the right spot to help those kids that we can identify, I'm not sure that testing, again, you're talking to a business manager, I'm not sure that testing is the one and only measure that we're going to have. But when you look at the test results and you look at the grouping of the kids in the buildings, I'm seeing kids that are behind grade level, not only in some of our higher poverty buildings, but in some of our lower poverty buildings, as well as seeing some of our higher poverty buildings moving along just fine. And so the question is, where do you get the dollars to be able to focus on those few that could still be helped? And, you know, that's, I don't know that the answer is completely testing as an evaluation tool, but we haven't even had that over the last 6 years. We've now got some pretty good tests that we can look at, and we'd like to try. We'd like to see if a small movement. That could be a lot of dollars that are going to change schools, but it would be significant to those kids in those schools to help them become successful, at least from an educational standpoint.
Representative Baker.
Madam Chair, Representative Grayling, to your point, actually on page 1, line 11, 10 and 11, it talks about there's test scores and other adequate yearly progress indicators. So the district is going to use all the indicators they can. And I want to point out this does not change the compensatory use of the money one bit. It merely is a deviation from the money to follow the child, which is the standard elsewhere, which makes a lot of sense in a school that has a high concentration. The issue with Anoka consistently has been that we have a low concentration because we have very large schools. And that's part of our economy of scale, how we can do as well as we do given, you know, the historical funding patterns for Anoka. But this is an effort to have the money follow the need based upon the concentration of students with needs, use them compensatory ways, use those list of ways, the uses will be the same. It's just who will, where you're going to focus those uses, where are the greatest needs.
Representative Grayling, and I know we've heard this story before from Anoka Hennepin as far as the large, they've got huge elementary buildings, larger than kind of the norm, and so they're free and reduced lunch count students are kind of spread out more than usual than in other areas. And I was kind of hesitant to, the original bill that Representative Abler brought was for the whole state, and I said, you know, no, I understand Anoka's got some unusual circumstances, and perhaps if they're struggling with trying to get some more dollars more targeted and this law is preventing them, try it in a limited way, but I wasn't ready to start moving away from the money following the kids, because I think that was the problem in the past, that we weren't, the kids, the money wasn't following those kids that needed it. So it's kind of an attempt to kind of look at this in a very limited way. But you have a follow-up that you want to ask?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a last comment. I'm glad it's a pilot. I said that already. I'm not comfortable with it. As probably Representative Abler remembers, I was totally wild about, and I'm not even sure if I supported compensatory revenue going to Anoka in this manner that we had this. You know, I think it's what you're coming here with us now is telling us that, in fact, because you don't have the concentration, I think that's why there's no correlation, and it just shows that if you don't have the concentration, then you shouldn't get the concentration factor, but the money, just the money following the children. Maybe I'm not totally straight on what you have managed to get passed with the legislature, but I'm concerned that maybe this is a result of, you know, of that. So maybe this pilot will shed some light on that, and we'll discover that, we'll learn something. I don't know. But I'm not comfortable with the pilot either.
Madam Chair.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Abler, I have to share Representative Greiling's discomfort in what you're asking here, because the fundamental premise behind compensatory revenue and the reason it is funded in the way that it is because children of families of modest means need extra funding to give them the leg up. Now, you're talking about concentrating the money into sites where there are greatest needs, but to get the money to one site means you have to take it from another, right? And therefore, you are leaving behind then the funding for some students at the school at which you take the money from. And that gives me a concern that maybe the fundamental premise in and of itself needs to be relooked at, and we've had conversation along that line already. We have 11 different uses for compensatory that range anywhere from supporting the purchase of additional teachers, which I understand would be difficult in a low concentrated area, but it goes all the way down to being able to provide additional instructional materials, which you could do if there were just simply one child in your building. So, you know, the fact that when you shift the money from one site to another, you actually take it away from some students who generated the revenue give me great concern. And I guess I'd ask, why would you not rather, because you are one district, why would you not rather look at creating sites where you can start center basing some of your programs? And I'll ask that and get your answer.
Unfortunately, compensatory aid and the way it applies to Anoka Hennepin is a fairly complex issue. The first issue is the issue of concentration. The issue of concentration, if you look at 100 students who need help or are labeled as free and reduced lunch in an average state-sized school of 300, that's a 30% concentration. Anoka Hennepin runs buildings that are an average size of 600, so you have those same 100 kids, but you get less dollars per pupil because of the concentration effect. But it's the same kids, the same test results, it's the same need for those same 100 kids. That's always been an issue for Anoka Hennepin, and that's one of the reasons why we don't get as much funding as we need to help those kids. And that's why we have a cross subsidy from the general fund to those types of programs. The second issue related to the compensatory is, now that we have the ability to very easily measure performance, we're starting to see patterns where we need additional resources in areas where we don't need those resources. Our goal as a school board or school district is to leave nobody behind. Our goal is to, we've got the deck of cards that have been given to us. We've tried to fix the compensatory formula to serve an Anoka Hennepin. And we just want to be able to have some flexibility to take and put this money where we believe it really is needed, and we're not going to take it away and cause other students to fail. That won't happen. That's not what we're going to do here. We're going to look at the tests that we give, the test results, and we're going to get those funds into the hands of the kids that really need it. And sometimes when we do these types of programs, we have some experience with it. In downtown Anoka, we had a school called Franklin Elementary, which made the AYP list. And we focused about $1 million with the grant funding over 2 years, and we took them from an AYP school to a 5-star school on the commissioner's report card. Now, not all of that is going to be a recurring investment. That some of that is one-time investment. That's a 1 year to get a staff in there, super teachers, best practices, team building, to find out how to get the staff all together working in the same direction. That's one-time funding. And then it can go somewhere else. And then some of it is ongoing funding. But there is no way that we want to leave any kids failing. We just want to have the flexibility at the local level to look at the measures and the metrics and the data that we have to allow us to allocate those resources the way that they need to be allocated.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank Representative Abor and the people from the Anoka School District for bringing this piece of legislation forward, because I think it does bring out an issue that we really need to have a discussion about when it comes to education finance. Should we be sending money to students, following students simply based on their income level, or in this time of accountability, should our money be focused on kids who need help with their learning? And we need to have that discussion. I think this bill brings out that issue once again, and I look forward to your pilot program being quite successful.
All right, if there are no other questions, thank you, Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Olson. You were on the list, and I ignored you. Sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to comment, too, that I think the goal of an education system is to educate children, all children. I have faith in my school district as a co-author to do a good job doing that. And, you know, we always say, well, how come education isn't more like private business or whatever? And then in the same breath, some people say, but we know best how to do things in St. Paul sometimes. And I think this is a step forward, saying Anoka Hennepin School Board and teachers do know how to do things. They're not going to sacrifice anybody's education for another, but they're going to make sure all their students are doing the best of their ability. And I'm glad Anoka Hennepin's doing this, and they're such a sizable school district. I do think it's going to be a good pilot for the rest of the state to see. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Olson. The next bill on the agenda is House File 2860. Members, this bill is a bill that came to us actually last week. It is the governor's technical bill to the forthcoming supplemental bill that we do not have as yet. So if you're wondering about that, I don't have it either. I just have this technical bill. Also, too, I wanted to make an announcement that just for the public's awareness, and I think the Democrats know this already, on Tuesday the 23rd, is it? We will start putting together our finance bill, and we will try to get the draft to Democrats and to the public hopefully Monday morning, sooner than that if we can, so that everybody has time to look at it and make amendments. But just wanted to give you a heads up. So this week is going to be a very busy week. We will have one final hearing on Monday to wrap up any loose bills that may come forth. But we will be trying to jam in as much as possible this week for hearings. And we will have an afternoon evening hearing on
Wednesday.
On Wednesday, so plan on that, but we won't have any other evening meetings unless it really becomes necessary to do that. Mr. Marcus, are you going to be going through the 2860 bill then?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right, go right ahead then and go through the sections.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Greg Marcus, Minnesota Department of Education. I have with me, to my left, Beth Oney from the department. I will speak to the first couple sections of the bill, and then Beth will speak to the ones following that, and then we'll be having other members of the department come up and speak to the other elements of the bill. First off, the first four pages of your bill, House File 2860, you'll see that the Department of Education is substituting the name, the Department of Health
I'm the Commissioner of Health in instances where I have been Commissioner of Education. The reason being that this was something that aligns better with the purpose, the mission of the Department of Health. It is also a responsibility that the Department of Health is currently discharging in a somewhat similar fashion. It is our understanding, or it is my understanding, that the Department of Human Services, already has a contract with the organization which performs the swab team activities that were formerly funded under the appropriation when it went to the Department of Education.
Members, so, we transferred the lead abatement program, I think, last year to the Department of Health, and we did not. Oh, it is in the governor's rex for this year. I apologize. And so then this would align that proposal.
That's correct, Madam Chair. It was discussed last year, and this would bring to fruition that discussion.
Okay, Representative Biernet.
Madam Chair, then doesn't that mean this bill would have to go to Health and Human Services Policy Committee for transferring from one agency to another? Should they hear this bill?
It could be that we should make sure that they hear it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's my understanding that there will be there is a parallel piece of discussion going on in the Department of Health, and that there actually this would not be a net savings to the state, the $100,000 involved here, but rather this would be money that would then show up in their bottom line.
Representative Biernet, I've been told by Mr. Crow that there is a concurrent piece of legislation in the Health Department that reflects the same information, so apparently they're hearing it too.
Madam Chair, does that meet committee deadlines then?
I would.
Two separate pieces of legislation, does that?
Well, this is in the finance area because it's a transfer. It's a financial issue, so yes, it would.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the next section we'll talk about will be led by Beth Hong.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the next section deals with staff development, particularly requiring that the staff development in the school district must be based on the results of a local needs assessment. That has not been required before, but it makes logical good sense that any kind of professional development program that the district sponsors would, in fact, be based on needs experienced by the teachers in that school district. So this just requires that it be built on the results of a local needs assessment. That puts our state staff development legislation in alignment with requirements from No Child Left Behind. It also defines criteria for effective professional development activities as defined in No Child Left Behind, and includes a few other criteria that have been identified in research as being characteristic of effective professional development activities. It also requires the submission of district and site plans to the state, and districts are currently doing that, so that would not be a new provision. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Representative Abler?
Well, didn't we just change this last year, Madam Chair? We would not require the reserve 2%. This requires the 2%
right.
reserve.
Right, right.
Madam Chair?
Representative Abler?
We've heard nothing but rave reviews from across the state except for one group who's looking at you right now. High group out there, not high group and the one nice woman behind you. But except for the one group, this should have told me that this flexibility that they had with that 2% has saved their lives, and they've taken that money, and rather than being told how they should spend it, they're taking using it in all new creative ways, even in some districts very much the same dollars, to work across their districts instead of by site per the last bill we had, per based upon the district's needs. Why would we presuppose that we would know better what would be an approved use than they would? And how do you have the staff to sit there and evaluate these plans to see if they're as good as the school district can figure out? Can you answer that, please, Mr. Marcus, or whoever?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, let me speak to the first part of it first, if I might. My understanding is what you've done is you've set aside, you have temporarily waived the set-aside, let's say, for the 2%, and that was going to carry you through the biennium, and then after that point, the 2% set-aside would come back into place. It's my understanding. This bill as written omits to have an effective date in there, so if we go forward with this, you probably want to have a July 2005 effective date. It's my understanding that's when the current temporary sunset, if you will, of the 2% set aside disappears, and so then this would take the place of that.
Mr. Marcus, though, however, in the current law, the way it was written, every year the teachers and the management can sit down and waive the 2% set aside. It's not just that it happened this year, but that's a discussion that can happen every year with the management and teachers.
Yes, so. Madam Chair. It's my understanding that, as I think I recall having read that in here, that continues to be the case in this language.
Right. Are there any other questions about this? I think we have some testimony in regard to this that we'll maybe come back to just hear. This is quite a big change from current law, and this, to me, was not necessarily a technical issue that we haven't really had a lot of discussion on this. To the extent that we have to confirm to No Child Left Behind, or conform to No Child Left Behind, pardon me, I would think that we are meeting that, but maybe we need a little bit of clarification.
Yep.
Mr. Marcus?
Yes, Madam Chair. To the point of NCLB, we believe that NCLB contains some good things and some bad things, much like legislation that other people can pass on occasion. But one of the elements that has gotten a good, strong review is that portion which deals with professional development, and the idea of looking at what the particular weaknesses of the school are before trying to form your professional development plan. So we are not required, per se, by NCLB to do this. It just would represent a best use of resources and a best educational practices, that if you're going to do a report of this sort, if you're going to develop a plan, that you might as well speak to the needs of that school rather than having two parallel tracks that aren't really aiming towards the same goal. So I would speak. That's one point that I'd mentioned. The other would be that to the issue of staff development language, we understand, having had some initial discussions too, that there are others that are concerned about some of the contents of this and what does this mean as far as the existing requirements that the legislature has put in place for staff development funds, or at least some of the requirements that are funded through staff development set aside money. And I would say, just to speak to that initially, that this is very much an initiative that is grounded in what we understand to be the best educational practice. And although there may be other things out there that we want to have staff receive training in, such as data practices and things of that nature, we're willing to have that discussion with you, because, of course, there are other concerns that the legislature might have. But this initiative that you see before you is one that's very much grounded in the issue of what is the best educational practice.
Why don't we go on, and we'll come back to this issue, if you can hold your questions on that, and then we'll come back to that, and let's just get through the rest of the stuff that maybe is, less controversial.
Okay. Then, Madam Chair, if we're going to move on to the portions of the bill that deal with finance, then we'll ask Carol Hokanson to come down. And while she's coming down, I think if I might also just speak to one labeling issue that we have had. You spoke earlier about the bill being being a technical change, and indeed that's one of the phrases that have been used for it. If I can try to give a little more background on that, we have begun to call this the department supplemental bill, to differentiate it from the governor's supplemental bill. And so just an FYI on that. So the issues contained in it may not in fact be all technical issues, as you've said, but rather something that is above and beyond what might be interpreted as being purely technical.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carol Hokanson. I'm out of the Division of Program Finance of the Department of Education. I'd like to go to Section 7, lines 8 through 10 on page 10. On lines 8 through 10, this defines the reserve revenue for area learning centers to include all basic skills, including limited English proficient revenue. When the LEP revenue was rolled into the basic skills revenue, the statutes were somewhat inconsistent as to whether that revenue should actually follow the site to where the students generated that revenue. What this amendment is doing is
making sure that it follows to the site. We believe that is the intent of the law.
All right.
Okay, Section 9, lines 35 and 36 on page 11. On the bottom of the page. This ensures that extended time revenue and transition revenue should be calculated for each charter school. The law is also somewhat unclear from last year's legislation as to whether that should be a state average or calculated at the site level, and this is just making sure that it's calculated at the site level that we're currently doing. Lines 2 and 3 on page 12. This defines the dollar amount for extended time marginal cost pupil units. Currently, extended time revenue is the basic formula allowance of $4,601. $223 of that is for transportation as a result of transportation being rolled into the basic formula. This $222 stays with the charter schools even if they don't provide transportation, so this is adjusting it so that would not be included. Line 17 on page 12 is just a technical amendment defining pupil unit to be an adjusted marginal cost pupil unit. And then if we go to lines 22 through 24, what we're doing there is if a charter school does provide transportation, then we are giving them the $223 back to them. On the bottom of the page,
Ms. Hawkinson, is the $223 is a savings to the state because it doesn't go to the district that's providing the transportation. Is that correct? I mean, does the district where the resident, where the pupil is coming from, they generate X amount of monies. So if it's not being kept by the district to provide transportation, it's a savings to the state then?
Madam Chair, right now the charter schools are getting that money whether they provide transportation or not.
Mm-hmm.
These last two amendments, one is taken away, one is giving back. There will be another amendment further in the bill that gives it to the district that's providing the transportation for the charter school, so there isn't a savings. It's just making sure the money goes to the appropriate entity.
Great.
That's
great. Providing transportation. Perfect.
Line 36. This just clarifies that compensatory revenue should not be prorated if a student is attending part-time, and that's because compensatory revenue is based upon a head count of students eligible for the free and reduced meal count.
Madam Chair?
Representative Biernick.
Could I go back to the page 10, a question on that 40% total? It's on lines 31 through 36, section 8.
Excuse me, I overlooked that one. Morgan Brown will be presenting that particular amendment.
Oh, all right. Good catch, Representative Biernan. I missed that one, too. Mr. Brown?
Madam Chair, Morgan Brown from the Department. Just to clarify what this provision is about, it's actually a follow-up, Madam Chair, to the clarification that you and Representative Sikora in the House and Senator Stumpf and Senator Kelly in the Senate provided to the commissioner during the implementation of the 2003 online learning bill last year. And whereas that clarification specifically pertained to programs and schools, particularly I think a lot we had some discussion about Cyber Village Academy, that had existed and been authorized under other sections of statute because they existed prior to the enactment of any online learning law. This would clarify that that same intent would also pertain to any new programs or schools that had the same model that came forward. And just for the benefit of other committee members, what we're talking about here is a instructional program, public education instructional program that I sometimes call a hybrid program, where there is substantial instructional time happening in a brick-and-mortar facility along with an integrated online learning component. We currently only have one school that does this, Cyber Village Academy, but it's possible that other programs or schools in the future could come forward that would want to do this kind of integrated program, and the evidence is that it's quite beneficial to students who are involved in it. So this provision of the bill clarifies the kind of confirms the legislative intent that for those programs, those students would be generating regular ADM rather than online learning ADM, because a substantial portion, and it's defined here as 40%, is happening in a brick-and-mortar school facility.
Okay. Do you have a question now, Representative Burnett?
Madam Chair, just to clarify that, then, if the student is taking meets the 40% threshold, the school would get full amount of the aid. Does the school or anybody else get the additional funding for the online instruction? Is the school district collecting twice for the student, or is this another entity collecting? Because it seems like if you're only counting a student as 40% of the 100%, there is additional revenue coming to the school on which the school is really not performing any service.
Madam Chair, Representative Burnett, no, just to clarify, if the student is enrolled in an instructional program where 40% of the instructional time is happening in a brick-and-mortar facility, what this clarifies is then that student only generates the regular ADM. They do not generate online learning ADM. So there would not be a double collection situation in that case.
I'm not sure that's clear in the statute, but if that's your intent.
I think, Representative Burnett, it may be clear if you go back into the online learning language, correct, Mr. Brown? Because there is some specific criteria for that, and I think it, but if not, we'll make sure that it is. Representative
Dixon? I always get worried when Mr. Strom has a puzzled look on his face, so if he could clarify
okay.
That.
Mr. Strom, have a puzzled look. I'm sorry. We better go to you. And
Madam Chair, Representative Burnett, excuse my puzzled look today. The purpose of this subdivision is simply to separate out which school programs fall under the online learning funding. So the 40% doesn't modify the average daily membership of the student, but rather it modifies the portion of time that the students spend at the physical site, at the building. And in the case of Cyber Village, what that essentially says is out of the week, the kids have to be in the building 2 days a week in order to count for regular funding instead of the online learning funding. And this is a result of the online learning program that we passed last year, where we created a separate funding stream for those children who were only going through an online learning environment and weren't showing up at the school or weren't required to show up at the school. So what this essentially says is if you're spending at least 40% of your time in a physical building, then you're funded through the regular general ed formula and not through the online learning formula, regardless of how your instruction is provided.
Okay.
Just a quick comment that on if you back up with the new language to the the generating clause, which starts on line 25, I think it's pretty clear that what it's spelling out is when you don't get online learning.
Mm-hmm.
All right, it says no online learning average shall be generated if, and then this new part is part of when you don't get online learning.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. All right. Ms. Hawkinson, do you want to continue with your part?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, lines 9 through 11 on page 13, they are again are ensuring that all basic skills revenue is directed to the eligible program. And that's also true for section 12, lines 30 through 35 on page on the same page, and it also addresses the issue of making sure that compensatory revenue is not prorated if a student is attending part time, and that is for the contracted alternative schools. And section 13, lines 25 through 29, it's deleting obsolete language related to the special education excess cost aid. And then on page 15, line 5 and 6, it's changing the fiscal years for 2003 and 2004. To indicate that those years would be the years that they'd be funded on a current year basis. And then if you move to section 15, it is beginning with FY 2005, changes the for current year to a reimbursement basis for excess cost aid. The reason why we are proposing that is that school districts have a difficult time projecting excess cost aid and accurately reporting their year-end data. Because of their inability to determine their year-end data in a timely fashion, they sometimes understate their aid, which causes a large adjustment in the next fiscal year. And we believe that providing a prior year's data would give them more predictability and stability in their numbers. We also would be able to pay out at an earlier date instead of perhaps 6 months into the next year, projecting to be able to pay out in October.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Representative,
can we back up? I'm sorry, I didn't catch it until I read it afterwards on Section 12 about the, we discussed compensatory earlier. Just why would you not want to reduce the compensatory if you're prorating the aid to their, is there a reason? I didn't understand that.
Madam Chair, Ms. Hawkinson, committee. Compensatory revenue is a headcount. It's based upon prior year's data, and it's a snapshot in time. A headcount is not in terms of average data membership. Average data membership, you can prorate based upon the amount of time a student is enrolled at a site or a district. A headcount is a point in time, and therefore it should be treated as a whole number.
Well, Madam Chair, it just occurs to me that, I mean, if it's a headcount, and we were talking about needs for kids and the whole discussion we had before, that, you know, needs for kids that maybe, I mean, I don't understand why it's not weighted. I still don't know why we couldn't improve it to reflect that a school should get the kids there to school. And I don't understand why if you have a half-time child, you'd get full-time. And why don't we call them a half-ahead then? You know, I mean, if we're, because this is a fiscal impact, and it would somebody will win, and then this is this a change from current policy, or is this a clarification?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, this is essentially current policy on this. What Ms. Hawkinson was saying is because the count is only taken once, we don't know whether that child as a compensatory student is there all year or not. We only know that they're there on October 1st when the count is taken, and this is clarifying the way that mm-hmm. the money transfer is currently working. There's no fiscal cost to doing it this way, and it should be corresponding to the practices of the department to make this change.
Yeah, that's fine to know.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It sounds like Ms. Hawkinson knows a lot about compensatory funding. Do you know in Minnesota history where classroom dollars were cut for school districts that, classroom dollars that were used for all students were cut when compensatory grew last year? Has that ever happened before? Are you familiar with that?
Ms. Hawkinson?
Madam Chair, Representative, no. Compensatory revenue dollars should not be substitute general education dollars. That would be a supplanting issue, but I'm not familiar with what you are.
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative Bernardi,
last year the governor did just that. He took classroom dollars that were supposed to be used for all students, took that money and balanced the state budget with it. And what he did is he offset it with compensatory fund. I mean, it was the offset with compensatory funding. So it was supplanted. I guess that you use the word supplanted. Has that ever happened before in Minnesota history? Is it legal? I mean, I'm not sure supplant is a pretty big word.
I am not familiar.
Mr. Marcus.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if I fully understand the representative's question, but I could say that we're not in a position to say whether something is legal or not. That would not be the role of this particular part of the department, maybe not to say whether it's something that's legal.
All right, Representative Biskens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just as long as we're still on this same section, I guess my question is the striking of the language on page 13, lines 33 and 34. Now, that's the language which, if we struck it completely from law, would make Representative Abler grin ear to ear, because that's the language which says that the money must go to the sites where the students are who generated the dollars. And I know that this is under the alternatives program provision of law, so, but I'm wondering what's the rationale behind that striking that language under the alternative programs provision.
Is that true, Mr. Marcus? Where the money will not follow the child anymore or compensatory?
Madam Chair, I don't know that provision of statute right off the back of my hand, so perhaps
Mr. Strom can maybe
Madam Chair, essentially what's happening is when the child is in the alternative program, we calculate the general education revenue that gets sent to the alternative program, and what the changes we're making essentially in this section are taking out the calculation of compensatory revenue for the initial amount that's paid on the district characteristics, because the compensatory revenue is calculated at the site level. And so the language that's being struck there is on lines 33 and 34 is essentially clarification language. That money still is going to the alternative program site. Mm-hmm. It's being calculated at that site, and essentially it just doesn't need to show up in how the aid transfer is working between the school district and the alternative program, because the students that are at the alternative program, their compensatory revenue is entirely based on the characteristics of that alternative program, not on the rest of the school district's characteristics.
So remember, this is a section on ALCs, not on...
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Diskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then either to Mr. Strom or Mr. Marcus. So then the assumption is there are no multiple site alternative programs. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Diskins, I think the issue here is we've got about three different kinds of alternative programs, and each of these sections is amending a different one of these programs. And this one is for the private contract alternative programs, where essentially it's operated by a private organization that's contracted for the district to provide that service. And so what we're calculating what follows then is language that clarifies the way that calculation works, so that essentially the district's characteristics are used for the average general education revenue, except for compensatory and LEP, which is calculated at the site basis.
So,
Representative
Diskins,
the
initial calculation for compensatory is calculated based on their headcount. And then when a district contracts with a private alternative learning center, then this language then directs them that they have to receive 95%, the sum of 95% of the district's average general ed, less basic skills revenue per unit, times the number of pupil units attending the program, and the amount of basic skills revenue generated by pupils attending the program according to Section 126C10, Subdivision 4. So the stricken language is really redundant language because it's already been done in the general broad sense of the word, and this is
Madam
more
Chair,
specific.
And I'll have to think more about this, but the stricken language has nothing to do with calculating the cost. The stricken language, and I've got it right here in front of me, is very specific towards building allocations. So it's not a calculation, it's an allocation language that we are striking. So that just takes my wheels a little longer to turn.
Yeah, well, no, but that was a good question to work through that, and I think we need to ask those questions. All right, further, Ms. Hawkinson, do you have any other changes here besides the initial cost?
Madam Chair, on page 16, lines 3 through 8, it creates supplemental excess cost aid. If we're changing to a reimbursement basis, some districts may experience increased costs in special ed from one year to the next. This creates a dollar amount where there's some increases that they would be eligible for this excess cost aid. And then further down on line 17 through 25, it defines the excess cost aid formula for FY 2005 and later. On page 17, line 36, it is again making sure that all basic skill revenue follows the site. This is for area learning centers. on page 18, lines 16 through 18, it is now giving a school district who provides transportation to charter schools the $223 for extended time marginal cost pupil units. It's giving back to the districts that are providing transportation. And then on the last page, on page 19, this is a technical amendment, lines 21 through 23. It's the amendment shifts the regional library telecommunication aid to an 80-20 appropriation. The original legislation last year had telecommunication aid and basic system support in an 80-20 appropriation, but when it wound up, telecommunication aid was to be paid out at 100%. That left basic system support underfunded. This is just trying to put it back to an 80-20 appropriation as was originally intended. There is no cost to this.
Okay. All right. Any further questions on these issues?
Madam
Representative Abler.
Just to revisit that section, one about that 2% set aside, and I just wanted to offer a comment. You said we could take up that. Is that
which
appropriate?
Page are you looking
page
at?
Page 5, about that staff development piece you were talking about. Just,
yeah.
If I'm laughing about the compensatory thing, this is a Representative Biscuit's dream, because you have people who are way smarter than the districts making decisions far away that will be considered immutable. Madam Chair, the benefit of, I happen to have three bills in this last year, just kind of fell onto them, but we really liked it, and this was something that was considered to be progress and flexibility, and the governor's task force coming out is going to talk about flexibility. So I'm hoping the department and the governor's task force wind up being on the same page as this should advance, because I think this will fly in the face of, again, having to have some district coming here saying, can we please do this plan instead of this plan, and give us a pilot project for 3 years to try a different staff development plan. So I hope we think carefully about this.
All right. We do have Representative Heigerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And addressing again exactly what Representative Eber was coming at, and I was smiling before, because I know exactly the 2%, what it did for some of my rural districts. It really gave them more flexibility, because up to this point, there was a lot of argumentation anyways between teachers and school boards as to where exactly the money should be spent. And when they let this up a little bit, I know I had some good positive comments from superintendents in my district. They liked the idea of what they did last year. Now, going back to what we've been doing, I think I'll meet some resistance. Thank you.
Okay, we do have about probably 10 or so minutes of testimony that has been requested on a couple of these issues. Okay, Ms. Allswiger, did you have some? And I don't know if the school board has some. Okay, so both do.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswiger, Education Minnesota. We would like to go on record supporting the language changes in House File 1789, dealing with staff development.
This is actually House File 2860.
I'm sorry, 2860. I brought the wrong one for me. And one of the reasons we would say this, and a number of reasons. First of all, staff development is critically important. Think about what we have done recently in the legislature. We have the social studies standards and the science standards coming up. You have recently passed the language arts and the math. These are items that will take substantial staff development. In addition to that, there's new curriculum adoptions for these standards and for other curriculum areas. In addition to everything else that's going on, discipline needs or writing analysis, and maybe even training on reading records. That was one of the bills that you heard. Currently in law, as Representative Segrin stated, there is a provision that allows the majority of the school board and the majority of the teachers to waive that 2% staff development requirement or to reduce it to anything less than 2%. So really, the question is, who is really going to support this reduction? I heard Representative Heidrichen say that the superintendents like it. I ask you this. are we really helping the instruction and the achievement of students if we reduce staff development? And if a group of teachers do not want to reduce staff development, why is that? Think about this in the bigger picture. Here's Education Minnesota, the teachers' union, saying that we advocate for less money that's available for other things, such as hiring teachers, for teacher salary. This eats into the budget. Why? Because professional development and staff development is so important for the education of our kids. So I ask you to seriously think about any changes. This change recommended here today is a good one. There were discussions between the Department of Education Minnesota and other parties. I believe MSBA was involved as well. And I think that they've got some problems with it. But one of the most important reasons for staff development, the requirement of staff development, is for improved student achievement. We talk about a closing achievement gap all the time. But if the teachers are concerned about it, it just means that there might be fewer teachers, there might be cuts in program areas. And if they still think that staff development is very important, then you have to ask the question, why? And why would you eliminate it then?
Okay, thank you. Representative Heidrich.
Yes, to that point, clarification. Right now, you had mentioned that you can waive it. The teachers and the board can waive it. My question is now, if this is passed, this will be a requirement, will it not?
Madam Chair, Representative Heidrich, it's my understanding that the language that would allow you to waive the staff development would still be in there, but I'm certainly open to correction if that's not the case.
Still in there? Okay. I was misunderstood there. Thank you.
It's still on page 8 and 9. It talks about prior to the end of the previous school year on line 4, page 9. A district may annually waive the requirement to reserve their basic revenue if by a majority of the vote of licensed teachers, et cetera, et cetera. Representative Bisnitz, and then we won't have the school.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick statement. I don't think there's anything in current law which would prevent the boards and the exclusive representatives from setting aside that money right now, all right, without the state having to mandate the set aside.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Grace Schwab with the Minnesota School Boards Association. Committee, I appreciate the opportunity to share our thoughts with you today. As we participated in this process and reviewed this bill before we came in, I want to share a few thoughts with you. First of all, staff development to your schools is extremely important. It's something many of us do above and beyond any requirement and place it as we go forward. Where we become challenged in this bill is the amount of education ease throughout it. Historically, staff development has been difficult for districts because we haven't known what was meant of us, what was required of us, what was covered by it. And we had really hoped for clarification in this bill, and that is not what we see. The other thing is the narrowing of the definition of staff development. The legislature throughout the years has required us to make sure our teachers are informed and knowledgeable in many areas. Data practices, bloodborne pathogens, we've had the EPI bill in front of us, asthma, violent student notification, crisis management, bullying, racial, religious, sexual harassment, and many others are required that our staff be knowledgeable in these areas. Present staff development language allows us to cover these topics, and maybe only in a day format, but definitely key not only to student achievement and student safety, student knowledge in the classroom, and what is appropriate in the classroom. We also have, the other piece we found as we reviewed the bills, we did not see a repealer of former staff development language, so if in fact this is the new piece, we would appreciate a repeal of the old, so we're not doubling up from one to another. I appreciate your time, and I'm open for any questions.
Ms. Schwab, I know you mentioned the page 7. It does say one-day or short-term workshops or conferences are not acceptable unless they are part of a sustained intensive program. I'm assuming that you're talking about some of those kind of short-term that you just mentioned as one issue that we may want to consider working out. if you could get us some language of some of the, I guess, education needs things that you are concerned about. I think in general, you know, if we can, my intent always with the staff development, and I think it's been a struggle, and I think everyone around the table, I sat today with some union representatives from one of the large school districts, and just talking about the importance of staff development that is aligned with school district goals and their needs, and not so much where individual teachers go off and do something that is continuing ed but really has no benefit to, you know, what's going on in their classroom. So I think people are on that same page, and I know that Education Minnesota has said that to me over and over and over about the importance of having the kind of good staff development that's needed. If you can get some, if you have some criticisms and critique of the language and you want to bring that forward, please do and let us know what it is. You know, maybe we can get together with Education Minnesota and the department and see if we can clarify this language if it's to go forward.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. We'll work on that.
Okay, we would appreciate that. Any other questions about this language? Okay, Madam, we have Representative Abel.
I'm curious as to the social language. Was this the national model, or is this something that the department wrote on their own?
Which language?
The whole staff development language.
Oh, okay. Pages.
You know, there's some, looks like there's some kind of imported language.
Yes, Ms. Downey.
Madam Chair and Representative, the language that you see here, especially the part under effective staff development activities, subdivision 5, some of that is taken directly out of the definition of effective professional development that is in No Child Left Behind. I'm looking specifically at lines 16 through 23, and lines 24 through 31 basically are drawn from sources that have synthesized what the research is telling us are characteristics of effective professional development that aren't necessarily included in the big definition provided in No Child Left Behind. And those are, that's research drawn from ECS, I believe, and the Council of Chief State School Officers.
Okay. Madam Chair, just one comment, then I'm through with this for now. It's funny, I marked off one of the sections you mentioned on page 7, lines 15 through 18. It talks about that you can't even have one day or short-term workshops. They don't count, and unless they're part of this intensive whatever deal. And Madam Chair, as this proceeds, I suggest we look at it in two ways. One is the 2% yes or no, and this language yes or no. And if we're going to do any of this stuff, I'm really nervous about it, but at least we can have two different conversations.
Okay. Well, I think it's raised, as I read it, I saw some really good things in here. And then I saw some stuff that was problematic as far as implementation and, you know, some of the issues that were brought up. So I think this is a good step, but it's a lot of to digest a week before we're going to be coming out with the bill. And I want to make sure that everybody's on the same page with this, because we have worked through the staff development language over a number of years and would like to continue doing this in a way that's thoughtful. Did you have a question, Representative Whitney?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For either of the testifiers, can you give me an operational definition of sustained intensive program?
Ms. Downey.
Madam Chair, Representative, sustained intensive program, lines 18 and 19 there, refers to a program of staff development that continues over time. It's getting away from the one-hour, two-hour, one-day kind of workshop that begins and ends in a very short, finite amount of time. So sustained in terms of it enrolls over time so that the teachers and others providing direct instruction to students have an opportunity to practice and think about the effect of what they've learned and what it produces in the classroom. In terms of intensive, we're talking there that the professional development is rigorous, if you will, enough so that it really makes a difference. The teachers really learn the knowledge and skills they need to improve either their content knowledge or their instructional skills or both, so as to produce improved student achievement in the classroom.
Madam Chair, Ms. Downey, can you give me a definition of effective?
Effective, as it's used in this legislation, refers to making a difference in student achievement to the positive.
Madam Chair, Ms. Downey, in both those definitions, you've talked about the implementation piece, implied at least, that the teacher is reflecting on the staff development experience, implementing it, and that's improving student learning in some respect. How are you measuring student learning from these programs that you'll sign off on?
Madam Chair, Representative, the state would not be measuring
meet the qualifications of this language.
How would the local district measure it?
Of the course?
How would? My concern is there's lovely language here, and you've done a very articulate job of explaining it, but I don't see a mechanism that actually provides brackets within which a school district can say, okay, this is a sustained, intensive, effective program that we can spend money on, and this one isn't. And I'm not seeing how they're supposed to separate sustained, intensive, effective from short. I mean, sustained would be 2 days then. You know, how if we're writing reports back to the department and the department is going to be maybe not passing judgment but certainly hopefully reading the reports, how are we defining these in a way that's going to be useful for school districts as they try to follow the law?
Ms. Halswager, I think, wants to maybe make a comment on that if you want to jump in, Ms. Halswager.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if you look at lines 15 through 19, which is, I think, the focus of most of the discussion right now, our interpretation of the sustained, overtime, intensive classroom-focused staff development would be, let me throw out an example, would be in the, you know, successful implementation, our goal would be the successful implementation of the language arts standards. And so then when you're developing your staff development plans at the district level, you have a broader goal. At the building level, you have a narrower goal. And then teachers within that end up having a narrower goal within their classroom. Sustained over time would be probably for year one, year two, and you want to always be evaluating it. It is my belief, when they look at one-day or short-term workshops, I think many people are thinking this. As a classroom teacher, marketers send from, you know, various staff development companies, send these one-day workshops, and we often like to laugh about them, the drive-by workshops, where you leave your classroom and you go and you take this wonderful, great workshop, often very good workshop, but does it fit into the whole plan of implementing language arts standards? And so I think that's what they're trying to get to, because some of these courses or these seminars can be expensive. Now, is it possible that this one-day workshop could fit into the sustained plan or the plan over time? Yes, I think that that's very possible. But previous to the staff development law, you know, if a teacher wanted to go to a staff development seminar or a workshop presented by a staff development marketer, the teacher would apply and she or he either was able to go or not. So I think they're trying to get away from these one-time, oh, I think I want to do that, versus does it fit in the plan through the district level and the building level.
And I know I had some discussion earlier this morning. It really wasn't on this, but we were talking about effective professional development, that actually what you learn, you then practice, you take back, and you actually, you know, do it in the classroom. And so many times you just have the classes, but you never take it back. And even as a team in a school building, identify that you need to do these certain things and have these certain skills. And so it's something that then is sustained because you're actually, you know, practicing it in the classroom. And I see one of the people here that I was talking to this morning about this topic. So, Representative Klinzing, you had a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I guess for the Department of Education, do you see, is this language presented on staff development, is it necessary in order for Minnesota to be in compliance with No Child Left Behind? Is it necessary to have this staff development language in state statute?
Mr. Marcus.
Madam Chair, Representative, no, it's not required to be in compliance with NCLB. The districts that decide to participate in NCLB that put in their Title I applications, as I understand it, need to do this. That is, they need to look at the needs assessment of their schools, and they need to develop a staff development plan that's in accordance with that. And the department then is in receipt of two different pieces of paper. As I understand it right now, your state law asks for a staff development plan to be developed and to be submitted to the state. NCLB, for those districts that participate in Title I, asks for something like this to be done for those schools. One of those asks that the practice of the staff development plan be aligned with the needs, specific needs of the school. The other, namely state law, doesn't have that degree of specificity. So rather than having districts submit two different plans, which may not be pointing towards the same goal, but arguably have the same purpose, namely that we want to, I think, make education better. We're trying to have some alignment between those two purposes to reduce the amount of work that districts then create, the amount that the department receives, and hopefully towards the end of having a better product. I'll let my co-worker, Beth Bowney, who can give you some title, I don't know what it should be, speak to that. I may have misspoken, but that is my interpretation of the situation as it currently stands.
Yes, and we, Madam Chair, we've received a lot of requests at the department for what kinds, what vehicles, what methods of assistance are you going to provide to us schools so that we can help teachers implement these standards in our curriculum in all the subject areas. And we know that in order to address their needs, we need to have accurate data regarding what they think the needs of their teachers are in their own districts, so that local needs assessment will help us understand what those needs are better. By having it reported to the state, we ensure that those needs are communicated. So this is bringing into alignment a more coherent, if you will, package of staff development, a more more coherence in the system between what the research says is what matters in terms of student achievement and how the district analyzes their needs by reviewing various kinds of data related to the resources that are devoted to improving teacher quality and the data regarding student achievement, and making some judgments as to the needs based on their review of data, and then finally communicating that to the state. This is done in many school districts, many good school districts. This is already happening. But this would be an attempt to make it more uniform throughout the state.
Representative Clancy?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also had a question for Education Minnesota, if I could.
All right. And then we need to move on real quickly. We've got just to review House File 1789. It was before policy. There are some, and we also have some amendments, actually, too, that we have to do for this bill that we need to quickly get done. So we need to move on. I think we have framed the issue. We need to work on it probably behind the scenes and get some heads together if we're going to go forward with this language. Ms. Allzweiger.
Ms. Allzweiger.
Representative Clancy.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Madam Chair. Ms. Allzweiger, a lot of this language looks very similar to policy that exists already in a school district in which I have worked for many years. In fact, I've sat on these staff development, district advisory staff development committees, as well as the site staff development committee. And I know, especially for the district advisory staff development committee, that we always had a representation of the district, which usually meant about 15 teachers at a cost of $100 per day to sit on this advisory staff development committee, because they'd be taken out of their classroom to go do this once a month for 10 months. So that's, I'm starting to do the math. It gets, racks up the bill pretty fast, because also I'm taking the teachers out of their classrooms to sit on this district advisory committee were paying for substitutes for them to be gone. And I'm wondering if it's the position of Education Minnesota that these hundreds of thousands of dollars are best spent on these task forces as opposed to actually on speakers coming out or to do workshops or teachers attending the workshops. I don't know, is it Education Minnesota's position that the payoff is there?
Ms. Salzweiger.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think it's a difficult to answer question to answer yes or no. I will, first of all, I'll address the issue that you said about the policy in your district. I would guess the policy in your district was probably likely because of the state law that was implemented. Before that state law, I think teachers worked a lot in their own classroom, on their own subject area, instructed their own kids, without the dialogue between the social studies department, the science department at the high school level, and the English department, where now you actually have English departments talking to social studies departments about what needs to happen between those two subject areas. And when you look at the elementary level, you don't have just individual teachers working in a fourth grade classroom. You have all fourth grade teachers talking to each other, and in fact you have kindergarten through fifth grade teachers in the K-5 model talking about, for instance, the development or the implementation of the language arts standards. If you go back to the old way, you have speakers come in and say, this is what you should do, 1, 2, 3. The teachers go back. They go back and teach in their classroom, but there isn't that dialogue that feeds each other, that keeps people interested and energized to improve instruction and to always evaluate. I think a big component of what has happened with the staff development language that has been implemented for the last few years is that schools, buildings, and districts and the people that work in them are saying, what are we teaching our kids? Is it working? They're evaluating at the district level, they're evaluating at the building level, and they're making changes with everyone included in the decision-making process to make those changes. So then I come back to your question, and that when you have the old model with speakers coming in, I think there's a disconnect between what should be happening in the classroom and that ongoing evaluation piece that really makes a difference for improved instruction and improved student learning.
All right. We need to cut this discussion off. We have three amendments to House File 2860 that need to be passed. The first one is 2860A1, and I'm going to let Mr. Strom explain it to the committee. It is technical, and it is in regard to taconite revenue. Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, committee members, the amendment H2860-A1 at the top has several sections in it related to the payment of taconite money to school districts. A couple of years ago, the legislature, the tax committee, changed the payment dates where the producers of taconite used to make a payment to the school districts in February. Now they make that payment twice a year, one time in February and the second time in August. The language in the K-12 part of the statutes was not adjusted at that time and still refers essentially to what would be the February payment date. So in order to make the year whole, the school districts need to be told that they can recognize that August payment as money for the preceding year. So that's essentially what these several sections do. They don't change the amount of taconite distribution in any way. They simply clarify the school district's receipt of that money to match the school district fiscal year.
All right. Are there any questions about this? If not, all in favor of A1, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposition? The amendment is adopted. The second one is A2, and this is a very technical amendment. It's on page 10, and it's actually strike the first comma and insert and strike the quotations. What does this do?
Madam Chair, this amendment essentially eliminates an obsolete reference. Prior to last year, when we created transition revenue again, we used to have something called transition revenue that expired the year before that had a transportation portion to it, but that's essentially removing obsolete language. So the the language and the transportation portion of the transition revenue adjustment. That's for a formula that no longer exists. So essentially that language is being struck.
All right. Any questions on that? All right. If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposition? The amendment is adopted. And the last one is A3. And this was brought to us by the Board of School Administrators, and they would like to be able to pay the cost of a substitute teacher that is employed when the regular classroom teacher is providing professional assistance to the Board of Administrators if they are going to some meetings. The Board of Teaching provides this payment, and I think it only involves one person that currently serves on the Board of School Administrators. Questions? Representative Biernet.
Madam Chair, is there a prohibition why we need a statute? Are they prevented from doing this ourselves? Because I just hate language that says they may do something when, which means they may not.
Yeah. Good question. Comment? Can't you do that now? Why do you need this may?
Madam Chair and committee members, when the board was first established, they looked at all means of paying for the substitute. They were prohibited from doing so. They sought out all means, and there is no other means of doing it.
Okay, and this is Mr. Belke?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, with the Board of School Administrators.
I serve as Executive Director for the board.
All right.
Madam Chair,
Representative,
that's the case, and if they want to do that, why don't we just make it a must instead of may?
Well, they may not want to pay him.
Well,
no.
They probably should pay them to reimburse.
Well, they should, but, you know, maybe they might want to do it gratis. I don't know.
The language is still very fuzzy.
Yeah. It's your call, Representative Biernet. If you'd like to change it to must, that's fine.
Madam Chair, it's your bill.
Well, that's, yeah, it is my bill. That's true. I would rather.
Good point.
Touché. I'd rather just leave it the way it is. I think this is coming from the administrators. They're comfortable with the may. Any other questions? All right. If not, all in favor of A3, say aye.
Aye.
Opposition? The amendment is adopted. Okay. That's all for this bill. We would like to bring up House Bill 1789, and we have some amendments to that bill that we want to get taken care of also. And we also want to move House File 2116. This is Representative Hilty's bill. Representative Krenke has requested that it be referred to capital investment because it has a bond savings. So I would move that House File 2116 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to capital investment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposition? The amendment is the motion is adopted.
Madam Chair, could we ask Representative Krenke if he's going to spend the bond savings in this bill?
Representative Biernet, I hope he's going to use the savings to fund something that I want really badly. But Representative Krenke, are you saving this money, spending it, or what are you doing with it?
I have to spend it all.
Okay. All right.
$215,000.
It's $215,000. That would cover half of my request. All right. Representative Socorro, you have some amendments to 1789. This is the original policy bill that was brought forth earlier in the session, and which is the first one that you want to move?
Madam Chair, this bill has been taken through three other committees already, but we're back here, I think, to rest. And let's take a look at, I guess, in order A3. And that's on page 28, and that's a very small change. It just clarifies the services that we're required to provide for children who are suspended or expelled from school for 10 days or more.
All right, any discussion on that? All right, if not, all in favor of this amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposition? The A3 amendment is adopted. All right. Next one is the A4.
Move A4. And what this does is allows a little more flexibility And I think we discussed this at some length in policy committee. It allows flexibility in how social studies are done. We had a credit system put in for social studies, 3.5 credits demanded. And what this would allow is, it's been brought to our attention that there are some school districts where the economics is taught by the business department. And so this would allow either the business department, it could either be enveloped under social studies or it could be taught under the business department, as long as they get their half a credit of economics.
And would also allow more flexibility, too, right, with history, U.S. history, world history, et cetera.
True.
Okay. Any questions on this? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposition? The A4 amendment is adopted. The next amendment is the AO41117.
Right, this one I'm going to ask Mr. Strom to explain. It's
Madam Chair, there's a couple of issues going on here. The first, let's deal with the second part of the amendment first, which is starting on compensatory education revenue on line 11 of page 1, and what this change does, this change from lines 11 through the top of page 2, line 6, what this does is compensatory education revenue is currently based on the count from the prior year's October count of students. And essentially, for school districts and school buildings that are stable, this isn't the problem. But what this is addressing is the issue if an alternative program essentially switches allegiance and is somehow not the same program. Instead of counting the money for past years in both cases, it would count for the, it would be based on the current year's count of compensatory and the prior fiscal agent doesn't get paid for it. So it's essentially if an alternative school, for example, were under the auspices of the Minneapolis School District and moved to the St. Paul School District, the compensatory aid would be paid to the new host, not if it were a fiscal host, not the old district. The second change on the back on page 2, lines 7 to 15, is defining the difference between reducing state aid and withholding state aid. This gets back to that discussion about the withholding state aid for not, and we'll have another amendment on this, for not turning in the financial work in a timely manner. And this clarifies when those payments are repaid if they're withheld. And then back to the front section, Madam Chair, this portion of the amendment clarifies the just make sure I'm looking at the right place here.
Madam Chair, I'm certainly glad I asked Mr. Strom to explain this one.
Madam Chair, this on the expenditure, this is back to that issue we talked about on the expenditures by building. What this does is require that the expenditures for secondary varsity revenue and elementary varsity revenue are allocated according to where they're earned. So essentially, in a school district that has an elementary site that qualifies for sparsity, it would allocate the sparsity revenue to that site.
Any questions on any of those sections? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposition? The AO41117 amendment is adopted. Okay. And
what remains is A8, Madam Chair.
A8, okay.
And I think what A8 does is the Senate made this change in theirs, and that was over, I think, some concern about withholding of funds. And so that takes place on page 10.
Actually, this is, we had some discussion about how we wanted to handle once we have the discussion about submitting financial data.
and making sure the districts or charters had some time to be able to look at their data, and so they provide the 2 months time period before the withholding kicks in. The other thing is that the commissioner, there's a percentage of withholding that has been designated, and it would be not more than 1%. So, for example, if you had a district that whose revenue was $7 million, let's say 1% of that would be withheld, or that would be $70,000 would be withheld until you got your financial audit in. And then the other is some technical on cross-subsidy reports. We have two reports. One is on special education cross-subsidy. The other was on compensatory. And so it just breaks those out and makes those clear as to how those are handled and when they're to be reported. Are there any questions on that? Mr. Deans, did you have a comment about any of those? I caught you up there, so might as well. Here's your chance.
Madam Chair, my name is Tom Deans. I was really just asking Mr. Marcus whether or not the language ever got in here that said that that once we got the auditor report in that we got the money.
Yes, you do. Yes. And okay. It is in there.
Okay.
Yes, it is. Yeah, so it's never continually withheld. You go get it back. Yeah. Any other questions? If not, all in favor of the A8 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposition, the amendment is adopted. Okay, now what's left in 1789? We're just going to do a quick review of what's in here.
Yes, this was heard at great length in the policy committee, and I think Representative Abler is probably the only one who didn't hear it in policy. It talked about school accountability, some of the graduation requirements. It touched on so many different little areas here. AYP data, and did quite a bit with LEP. There were some changes made in the way we look at LEP that we have gotten, I believe, approved by, at the federal level. And some rulemaking, it allowed some rulemaking, which was done in government operations for supplemental service providers and just rules on test security and statewide testing. Online learning parameters, do you want to talk about any of those? Or any of the other things in that beginning that I kind of slid over? Some also there were some parameters defined on online learning. Most of this other stuff was relatively technical, other than what we've dealt with here.
Any questions on 1789, Representative Piker?
Yes, Madam Chair. On page 11, line 26 through 30, and I'm wondering why we went away from section 126C.13. When I look at, it seems like we've changed the makeup of a definition of the levy. When we took out general education revenue, used to be in there, as well as shared time according to section 126, referendum made. I really don't understand the new wording, why we went from one to the other. It seems that this change could have an effect on some of the property poor districts looking at this.
Mr. Strom, can you explain that better than I could, I'm sure?
Madam Chair, Representatives Sikora and Heikirkin, what happened here is that the general ed levy is the, what the reference in 126C13 sub D2, that's what that referred to as the old general ed levy, and that doesn't exist anymore. So instead of certifying that non-existent levy, what we're telling them is to break down their voter-approved and non-voter-approved levies. So it's a clarification. It shouldn't really affect anything. That's the way that we're doing it now. But it just takes out the reference to the old general ed levy.
Any other questions to 1789?
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
Just a comment in general. And the bill's fine. It's, you know, I read it over, and I feel equipped to vote on it, even though I didn't have the earlier hearing on it with the policy. But I Just a word to the department and the governor's office if they're listening to this. Mr. Marcus, perhaps you can relay this message. We talked about in the previous bill about how this these are contiguous development money, these code projects shall be, and now you're talking about how rigorous the courts have to be to get a waiver from these standards we have, and we talked about how they really should think about having a gifted and talented program and how important that is to us. And they should think about it, you know? And I hope that next year's bill will include some stuff they don't have to do, and to show that we have some confidence in our elected officials at the local level, and they really intend well, and that we don't know as well as they do. And wherever possible, we cannot make them do things, and we let them focus on their own individual districts and the needs of their kids. I think we're kind of losing part of that, and I've been in this committee now, it's my sixth year, and I hope, and I try to bring some of those bills forward, if you know, and some go well, some don't go quite so well. But I hope that the department can listen to their folks out there as we attempt to serve best the students that we have. We know there's some lean times ahead for us, and the more the districts can focus on their work at hand and not do some of the things that we suggest they do, I think that would be better. So, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative
Sikora. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Sikora, I just have a question on the bill summary from House Research. It says the bill does not contain the governor's new education initiatives. And in our last bill, it says the bill does not contain the governor's supplemental budget initiatives. Madam Chair, are we going to be having these at some time since the policy deadlines have passed? Are we still going to be having the governor's new education initiatives in another bill?
Thank you, Representative Slawick. Yeah, we just haven't gotten it yet. I've been asking the same question as far as some language, and it will meet the deadline because it's all finance stuff. Whatever policy stuff that the governor had, we have heard that in Representative Sikora's bill. But the financial ones, we're still awaiting some of the details on those, and we will be hearing those.
Madam Chair, will we have those by Friday?
Yes, we will. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we will. Yeah. Otherwise, we are going to spend a couple more nights here. So we're trying not to do that. But okay, any other questions? If not, thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair. This meeting is adjourned.